This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, June 28, 2007. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, we'll hear from Washington, where the Senate fails to move forward on the immigration reform bill. At the U.S. Social Forum, groups tackle the issue of sexual assault against Native American women. And the Supreme Court's conservative majority rules against voluntary desegregation in public schools. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. The White House has moved to block congressional subpoenas issued as part of the investigation into the dismissals of eight U.S. attorneys. A letter issued today by White House counsel Fred Fielding states that President Bush is exercising executive privilege to keep those subpoenaed from turning over documents. The announcement comes just one day after the Senate Judiciary Committee issued subpoenas for documents relating to the administration's warrantless wiretapping program. Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Patrick Leahy described the president's move as, quote, Nixonian stonewalling. Israeli President Moshe Katsav has agreed to resign as part of a surprise plea bargain that allows him to avoid jail time for sex offenses. Katsav has been the subject of a year-long investigation into charges of sexual crimes against former employees. Rape charges have been dropped, but the Israeli president has pleaded guilty to charges of sexual harassment, indecent acts, and obstruction of justice. The U.S. and the EU have revised a deal to share data on all passengers on transatlantic flights under the pretext of fighting terrorism, Sudhaman Nipar reports from Berlin.
Within minutes of a flight's departure from the European Union to the United States, up to 34 pieces of data, including passengers' names, addresses, seat numbers and credit card details, are forwarded to U.S. authorities. Sharing this information actually breaches European data protection laws, but in 2004, the European Commission and the governments of the then 25 EU member states negotiated an exemption for the US. However, last year, the European Court deemed the 2004 agreement to be illegal and gave the EU until the end of July 2007 to come up with a new deal. Under the latest draft agreement, the 34 types of data would be reduced to 19, but the United States would be able to keep this data for up to 15 years. The European Union's data protection supervisor, Peter Houstonix, has criticized the deal, saying that the privacy rights of EU citizens have become casualties in the US war on terror. European authorities will release the details of the passenger data exchange program tomorrow. Sinemin Nippard, reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Berlin.
The U.S. House of Representatives has overwhelmingly approved a short-term extension of a South American free trade agreement, but some in Congress have indicated that the president's fast-track authority may have a tough time when it comes up for renewal. Matt Kay reports from Capitol Hill.
The 365-59 House vote for an 8-month extension of the Andean Trade Preference Agreement cleared the way for possible action soon on trade deals with Peru and Panama and maybe Colombia at a later date. But the vote angered Democratic critics of the deals, who have vowed to oppose any renewal of presidential fast-track powers which expire Saturday. Fast-track authority speeds trade deals through Congress on up or down votes without allowing for changes or amendments. Ohio Representative Marcy Kaptur.
We're here today to say that this process of fastballing trade measures through the Congress on fast track is over, because we have to begin restoring a regimen in this country that creates American jobs, not exports them, and begins to represent the American people at the table of global trade.
Kaptur vows legislation to fix inequities she says exist in NAFTA and will join with House and Senate allies to propose tougher new labor and environmental rules for all future trade deals and for renewing presidential trade powers. Matt Kay, Washington.
Hundreds of thousands of public sector workers in South Africa have called off their 4-week-old strike. The Congress of South African Trade Unions, known as COTASU, joined smaller independent unions in accepting a 7.5% wage hike. The strike was the largest show of force by organized labor since the end of apartheid. Maoist rebels in eastern India have been carrying out a campaign of shutdown strikes and sabotage in opposition to governmental policies to promote big business investment in the region, FSRN's Vinod Kijos reports.
State governments across a broad swathe in southern, central and eastern India have made themselves largely unpopular due to aggressive promotion of industrial development projects and so-called special economic zones. Small farmers have been among the hardest hit as governments appropriate their land to make way for industrial complexes. The level of frustration has allowed a well-organized Maoist guerrilla force to acquire the muscle to openly challenge the state and its economic system. Maoists in the state of West Bengal enforced a successful two-day shutdown strike earlier this week. Before dawn yesterday, 100 Maoists raided a railway station there, chasing away railway authorities and damaging the station's signal network. On Tuesday, the Maoists blew up tracks and partially destroyed a cargo train in the neighboring state of Jharkhand. The attacks come after weeks have seen blockades, strikes and acts of sabotage targeting railways, communication system and mining companies. The government take it as a law and order issue and sent more troops. For FSRN from New Delhi in India, this is Vinod K. Jose.
And those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The Senate immigration bill was halted for the second time this month. Members failed to gain the 60 votes necessary to move forward with the bill. It was a successful bid to kill the bill by a number of Southern Republicans. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
During the crucial vote on immigration, supporters packed the hallways outside the Senate chamber. Gustavo Torres is with a group called Casa de Maryland. He brought to the Capitol 24 day laborers to lobby lawmakers.
The workers make a decision to close the worker centers to come here and say, we want a comprehensive immigration reform.
Close by was Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff and Commerce Secretary Carlos Gutierrez. They hoped their presence as administration representatives would sway people to vote to allow the bill to proceed. But they had little sway. Senator John Kyle, Republican of Arizona, one of the architects of the bill.
Most issues are not like this, but this is one where you come to the position and it doesn't much matter what a friend or colleague or the president or anybody else says to you, you believe that's what's best for your particular state. So the president didn't have a great deal of ability here to go out and twist arms.
The Senate was far from the 60 votes needed to keep the bill going. Only 43 members supported it, 12 of them Republican. A group of Southern state senators succeeded in gaining enough momentum to derail the legislation, including Senator Jim DeMint, Republican of South Carolina.
But I think the work that a lot of us did slow things down enough for the American people to see what was going on. It gave a little more time for phone calls to come in, and I think it did make a difference.
Senator David Vitter is Republican of Louisiana.
I'm absolutely pleased about this.
Members say it was political pressure from constituents that turned them against it. An overwhelming number of calls to the Capitol on immigration Thursday morning caused the Capitol switchboard to collapse. But Senator Dianne Feinstein of California refers to the call volume as the vocal minority.
You know, the calls are very heavy calls. I think it's 20% of the population that is very exercised about this.
But that vocal citizenship has been intense. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid spoke about a letter he received Wednesday.
The letter was addressed to me and said, among other things, you probably should go into the witness protection program because of your work on this immigration issue. That's from Searchlight Nevada, Mr. President. This doesn't take into consideration the letters and the calls at my offices in Reno and Las Vegas and here in Washington get filled with hate.
The debate has brought up sensitive issues of race and class. The Southern Republicans have been accused of being anti-brown-skinned immigrant, as the majority of undocumented immigrants are Latino. That's a claim, though, they reject. Senator DeMint.
I haven't gotten one call that could have even been interpreted in any way as anti-immigration. It is more really about our country, what it means to be a citizen and enforcing the rule of law. And basically our oath of office that is to swear to protect the Constitution. Americans just feel like they're losing something that's much bigger than any one issue like immigration.
Senator Bob Menendez, Democrat of New Jersey, opposed many aspects of the bill, including the removal of a family-based immigration system. But he voted to move debate forward. He gave a passionate speech on the Senate floor shortly after the vote.
Throughout my life, and most recently on the Senate floor, I have heard the phrase, those people, those people. Those who use that phrase are the voices of division and discrimination. They are the xenophobes that exist today and have existed at different times in our nation's history, but whose voices have ultimately been overcome to give way to the greatest successful experiment in the history of mankind, the United States of America, that we know today.
Groups opposed to legalization are praising the outcome, while bill supporters have mixed feelings. Some call it a huge defeat for immigrant communities. But Deepa Iyer, executive director of South Asian American Leaders of Tomorrow, says the outcome will prove difficult.
The bill was in a form that would have had a much more negative impact than a positive one, especially on the South Asian community, which is our focus.
Talks have begun on how to move forward. One proposal is to break the bill apart and take it up in sections. Another is to allow the House to have a try. But pessimism was blatant on Capitol Hill on the future, not only about immigration, but on any difficult legislation that needs consensus. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
In a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court ruled against voluntary desegregation in public schools. The High Court heard appeals and cases involving two public school districts, one in Kentucky, the other in Washington State, where parents say the use of race in determining school assignments discriminated against white students by barring them from attending popular schools. We're joined on the line by John Britton. He's the chief counsel with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights in Washington, D.C. Can you briefly explain the strategies that these schools in Kentucky and Washington were using to promote school diversity and why they were challenged?
These schools, in various forms, but collectively put together, had a choice program. Everyone was assigned to the neighborhood schools. However, parents were given the option to choose a certain other schools. These schools were spread throughout the cities, and they were somewhat like magnet schools, maybe even some charter schools. They were nevertheless schools that were very attractive to parents to leave their neighborhood school and go to them. The district set up criteria for the transfer. They often included whether the family had any previous siblings in the school, whether the school was too far away from their home, what was the educational program of the school, and the need of the child. And in the end, plans were designed to promote racial integration, cultural diversity, by keeping it from tipping too much for one race or the other. If all those other criteria did not result in a child getting into the school, then the school system turned to race. And they had a broad percentage range of the race for that school. Several white students in each of those school districts who didn't get their top choice brought suit, claiming that the racial factor for determining the assignment of a child to the school violated the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution.
Can you talk about the idea of diversity as a compelling government interest and what was argued in terms of narrow tailoring?
The test for when the government may use a race-conscious means to carry out some government function, such as in this case education, is known as the strict scrutiny test. This test has two parts to it. The first part says that whatever the government wants to do, in this case promote integration in the schools, must satisfy a compelling state interest. And the second part of the test, which after surviving the first part, that whatever the government wants to do is a compelling state interest, must use the least narrow means, must use narrowly tailoring means in order to avoid any harm to the population that doesn't get included. And in this case, there would be non-minority persons. That's what is at stake in these cases, and that's what narrowly tailoring means. Narrowly tailoring also means that you must try and use some non-racial means, such as you could use social and economic means to assign students to school, particularly for poor students. Or you could use students from a certain geographic area, often facing disadvantage, and say that those students in that area would go to the school. Or in some other instances, you could use where you put the school in terms of, shall we say, an even distance location between two different racial and ethnic groups of neighborhoods whose children would go to that school as the local neighborhood school.
And who's going to be most affected by today's decision, and what is it going to mean for those students?
I think it means school boards who want to promote racial integration have to go back to the drawing boards, as they say. They can still do it, but they have to plan it, and they have to articulate it very carefully, the way colleges have to do. I think for communities of color and for their friends who support integration, they will see this as a barrier, but they will be able to overcome that barrier and continue on the road. Again, the best part of the decision for those who favor integration is that the court says that schools may still use race as a factor in promoting integration under certain circumstances.
We've been speaking with John Britton. He's the chief counsel with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. Since the end of last summer's devastating 34-day war with Israel, Lebanon has been plagued by violence. Car bombings, increased sectarian strife, and two targeted assassinations of anti-Syrian officials, all since last November. For the past 5 weeks, well-armed Islamic militants have been battling Lebanese security forces in northern Lebanon. Meanwhile, the pro-Western government has joined the U.S. government in blaming Syria for the unrest. In Paris this week, U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice reiterated U.S. support for UN Security Council Resolution 1757, which aims to set up an international tribunal to prosecute those responsible for the 2005 assassination of Lebanon's former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. Syrian officials are alleged to have been involved, and as FSRN's Jackson Allers reports from Beirut, the UN tribunal will likely be the next battleground for Lebanon's government and the political opposition led by Hezbollah, a group that maintains close ties with Syria.
Lebanon's pro-Western government has used the recent civil unrest to perfect its case against the Syrian government, which it sees as the force sowing the seeds of conflict in Lebanon. Even though the Syrian military pulled out of Lebanon after the 2005 assassination of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri, many believe Syria still has strong influence over Lebanese political affairs. In 2006, a UN-led probe into Rafik Hariri's death implicated Syrian intelligence figures. Paul Salem is the director of the Carnegie Endowment's Middle East Center in Beirut.
Most Lebanese would very much prefer that the investigations turns up something else, and that would enable Lebanon and Syria to resume very excellent relations. They are our large neighbor, they are our partners, no matter what, for the future of both countries.
Salem says that the extent and intensity of assassinations in the last 2 years is what prompted two UN Security Council resolutions aimed at bringing Rafik Hariri's killers to justice. While the proposed UN tribunal is yet to be formed, its critics say the government has used Syria as a scapegoat to avoid responsibility for domestic problems like the $40 billion debt and the stalling of reconstruction projects for the scores of southern Lebanese villages destroyed by Israeli bombing in last summer's war.
Why should I know who killed Rafik Hariri? And why should I pay to know that? I don't care.
Rasha Abdallah is a Shia whose family is from the southern village of Sharifa. Although she doesn't explicitly support the government opposition, she echoed the sentiments of many in the Shia community who question the motives behind an investigation into former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri's assassination, especially considering no one has been brought to justice for a political assassination in Lebanon since 1976.
If it's an international game to condemn Syria, why should I pay for that? I don't agree on that, and I don't want it. And I don't want to be part of condemning Syria.
The UN tribunal has driven a sharp wedge between the government and the supporters of the opposition movement, particularly the Shia group Hezbollah, which gets material and political support from Syria. The opposition, including a large contingent of Christians allied with Hezbollah, contends the UN tribunal violates Lebanese sovereignty and was not approved of by the Lebanese government. Abed is a Sunni activist from Beirut. Unlike a majority of the Sunni Muslim community that supports the government's position, Abed says he is against the UN tribunal because he sees it as an attempt by the international community to assert itself over Lebanese affairs.
لتساهم بدخول اليون وفرض القرار 1900
The UN tribunal is the main way of saying to the international community and to the UN Security Council that we are asking for more foreign intervention in Lebanon. It is a way of saying we cannot even control our own security, so help us.
Most analysts see only additional problems between Lebanon and Syria as the UN tribunal moves forward. Still, Middle East analyst Paul Salem says that the UN tribunal need not obscure other problems.
One would say one should have this investigation, maybe one should have other investigations. People have called for investigations into, you know, responsibility for the repeated Israeli attacks on Lebanon and war crime charges against Israeli generals and leaders. That is all relevant and that should go ahead. But that doesn't mean that if you can't get that one, you should cancel this one. And I think most Lebanese want these assassinations to stop. They want politics to be conducted through politics, not through assassinations.
Other local analysts contend that the international decision to form the UN tribunal actually takes pressure off of the Hezbollah-led opposition that can now claim they oppose the decision without losing face with Syria. Meanwhile, the UN tribunal is set to include Lebanese and international judges and is expected to be conducted outside of Lebanon because of security concerns. Reporting from Beirut, this is Jackson Allers for Free Speech Radio News.
Some 7 million acres of forest are being cleared in Indonesia for palm plantations every year. The government plans to double the number of plantations in the next 6 years to meet rocketing worldwide demand for biofuel made with the palm oil. They argue it will lift poor communities out of poverty and create millions of jobs. But the indigenous inhabitants of central Kalimantan, the Indonesian province of Borneo, are being forced off their land to make way for this development. Dayak nomadic farmers who have lived in harmony with the forest for thousands of years are losing their ancestral lands at a dramatic rate. FSRN's Rebecca Henschke has more.
On the wooden floor of a traditional longhouse on the outskirts of Palangkaraya, central Kalimantan, Eddie strokes his leg. He was shot by the police in May 2005 while protesting against a palm oil plantation owned by the Indonesian company Mitra Medawe Sejati.
Kami marah karena hak kami dirampas oleh mereka dari perusahaan.
We were fighting against the theft of our land. Then the police came to defend the company and shot at us. One person was killed, two were seriously injured. I was shot through the leg.
Saling tembak menembak. Jadi saya sebagai korban.
The shootings have never been investigated, despite 2 years of campaigning. The company they're up against has close family ties to the country's largest political parties, Golkar and PDIP.
Ya, saya masih tetap tinggal di runtuh, tapi sudah tidak memiliki apa-apa.
Now I own nothing. I have four children, and we try to survive from fishing. However, the rivers are being polluted by another palm oil plantation, Astra. It's very hard to find fish now, because the water is polluted by the chemical runoff from the plantation.
Karena limbah itu turun ke sungai, langsung menimbulkan ikan mati.
The central and local governments say the rapidly expanding palm oil industry will bring much-needed investment to this region. Sitipu is the manager of one of the nearby Macking Group plantations. He says they're working in partnership with the indigenous community.
On part of our plantation, we have created a system where 50% of the profit goes directly to the local community and 50% goes to the company. The local communities are also invited to become staff, and many are.
But the majority of workers come from outside Kalimantan. It's sunset as we drive up to a row of wooden houses in the middle of the palm oil plantations. Children are playing in the dirt. This is home for workers who've come from all over Indonesia to work for the Malaysian Kalim Group plantations.
My name is John. I'm from Flores. I've been here for 6 months. For us, the most important thing is that we have jobs. In Flores, there are not any industries, so it's hard to find a job.
They're hired on a daily basis, paid $3 a day, and have no job security or other rights as workers. The nearby indigenous village of Danau Sempulu is surrounded by a sea of palm oil plantations. 60-year-old Edwadi, like most of the people here, was a nomadic farmer who harvested forest fruits, rubber, and hunted animals in the surrounding jungle. He says this way of life has been lost forever. He pulls out papers to show me the money he was offered by the palm oil companies for his land. He refused to take it.
When I met with the company, I told them, you have to understand that this forest is our office. You want to destroy our office. Where will we go? How will we survive?
His forest land was cleared despite his protests. He, like most people here, didn't have a legal title to the land. There is a provision in Indonesian law for ancestral or traditional claims to land called tanah adat. But in practice, this law is very rarely recognized. The community here now survives by fishing in the nearby lake, while a select few are working on the plantations. Edwardi tells me his children have left for the provincial city in the hope of finding work. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Rebecca Henschke in central Kalimantan, Borneo.
According to the U.S. Department of Justice, Native American women are more than 2.5 times more likely to be raped or sexually assaulted than other women in the U.S. FSRN's Karen Miller reports from the U.S. Social Forum in Atlanta, where several groups highlighted this often ignored issue.
Today, the Indigenous Women's Network met with representatives of Amnesty International at the U.S. Social Forum in Atlanta to discuss an issue that's not widely talked about in Native American communities, rape. A recent study by Amnesty International titled Maze of Injustice, The Failure to Protect Indigenous Women from Sexual Violence in the U.S. says that 1 in 3 Native American women are likely to be raped in their lifetime and that Native American women are the least likely to report a rape. Adia Ali from Amnesty International also says that health care after a rape is a very serious issue and that sometimes women in the Native American community find it hard to get.
Healthcare is what we call economic, social, and cultural right. It's the right that everyone should have. And so women who aren't given this access to healthcare, they're having their rights violated all over again. First, they're raped, that's a violation. And then they can't get the type of treatment they need, that's a second violation. So we believe that they definitely need to have that access and should be federally mandated that they do. And the U.S. has signed an international human rights standard that says they should, but it's not living up to those obligations.
The relationship between federal, state, and Indian tribal laws can sometimes undermine local officials' capacity to respond to crimes of sexual violence. Kim Mettler is an attorney with the Indigenous Women's Network. She says that sometimes it's a question of who has the power to do what.
When you're trying to figure out who has the authority, you have to ask yourself, what is the race of the perpetrator of the crime? What is the race of the victim of the crime? And where did this happen? So if I was a tribal cop and if I was also a state cop coming in, I would be arguing with the other guy saying, well, this is state land. It's not Indian land. And the guy who did it was non-Indian guy, so I have jurisdiction. And until there's somebody there to show the map and to positively identify the perpetrator, this argument goes on and on and on and on and on.
Sharana Stoyer is the executive director of the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center. She talks about what sometimes happens to survivors of sexual violence in the criminal justice system.
A lot of times her statement is taken and there's never any arrest that's made and her case is left just dangling forever without her receiving any kind of closure to it. If in the event the community, the prosecutor has it together and decides to prosecute, he needs a number of things in place in order to be able to get a conviction, and that's forensic evidence. And so if there was no forensic evidence that was taken at the Indian Health Service, then he's not going to get a conviction, so it'll never get any further than a suspect that is arrested and held for a few days.
Currently, several Native American activist groups are urging Congress to support the Violence Against Women's Act that includes a tribal title seeking to improve safety and justice for Native American women. For Free Speech Radio News in Atlanta, Georgia, I'm Karen Miller.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Special thanks today to Cecilia Brennan. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.